a little bonus episode of the Tall Can Audio Podcast for your Tuesday, March 5th, 2024. Exactly 20 years since the infamous Senators Flyers brawl. Thought we might have a little fun talking to Sens play-by-play man Dean Brown about that. He was in the building, called the whole thing. Thought that might be fun just to celebrate the occasion a little bit for the Sens fans who listen to this podcast. A lot of you here in this market, obviously. I will remind the good listener that earlier on today, it's like I said, it's a two-show day here on Tuesday. Our friend Angela Thompson was on the podcast from Lake of Bays Brewing Company. Had a great chat with her about the brewery, about the beer scene right now, and of course, some sports talk as always. Don't forget on Wednesday, our friend Andrea from the Bytown Beer Sisters makes her TCA debut. They've got a cool event coming up. We're going to talk to her about. Lever will be here on Thursday morning as usual. Steve Bunda back in here on Friday. It's going to be a good week on the Tall Can Audio Podcast. But as I mentioned, March 5th, 2004, 20 years ago today, the infamous brawl between the Philadelphia Flyers and the Ottawa Senators. And the man behind the microphone, the man in the booth that night is with me today. Dean Brown is back on the show. Thanks for making some time, Dean. How are you?
I'm doing well, Matt. No, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
There's a few different places we could start on this, but I wonder if you could take me, you know, most people have certainly Sens fans have seen the video and remember this game pretty well. Mm-hmm. I'll be honest with you. I was talking to my co-host Rob about this on our Monday show. I don't really remember this. Now, everyone knows I'm not a Sens guy, but when I think of the big Sens brawl, I always think of Buffalo a few years later.
Yeah.
And so for whatever reason, this one just didn't stick in my memory as much until I saw the video and you're like, oh my God, can you paint the picture for me of what started this? Because in the video highlights that I've seen, it's clear Martin Havlat has something to do with it, but he is not involved in any of these fights. Why was this thing ready to boil over?
Well, I think that based on stuff that was said afterwards, I think it probably bubbled over or boiled over, mostly because Donald Brashear was angry. So something was going to start, and he was already angry apparently in that game. And when Martin Havlat high stick Mark Recchi, that kind of just that meant that something was going to happen. And then I'm pretty sure that Brashear, the first really overt act is when he grabbed Rob Ray and gave him a thumping.
Right.
And that kind of just set wheels in motion because then guys are, you know, like linking up. But it was a stop-start kind of thing. It's like it wasn't like one brawl and then everybody was kicked out and then they went on. It almost seemed like, you know, the next lineup, there'd be more fights. And then the next lineup, there'd be more fights. So it kind of came more in waves than any one thing where there was just this one drop of the gloves and the benches cleared, because that really wasn't what happened. It was like several waves where the next line that came out, well, you got to kind of grab somebody, you know?
Yeah.
But for me, it was awkward because Gordon Shribes were doing the radio for that game and Greg Millen and I were doing the TV. And this may sound weird, but it's more difficult to do that kind of thing on television because television has to focus on one thing. And so whatever the pictures are on the air, as the broadcaster, that's what you have to talk about. Well, if there's multiple things going on, you know, you can see them all and you can see what's going on, but you can't talk about this one because people can't see it.
Right.
So, you know, on radio, you know, voice and Gordy could go back and forth and tell what's happening in this bout and what's happening there. And, oh, this guy's grabbed this guy here. But, you know, we could do far less of that on TV because, you know, TV is a different animal. The producer and the director are in a truck outside. They're not even in the building. So they can see what's happening on their screens, but they can't get the whole sense of who's coming over the boards or who's screaming or, you know, what's going on. So it ended up being more difficult to really kind of lay that out on television in the moment, because later on you can go back and there's, you know, all the cameras are recording. Mm-hmm. So you can go back and show different things, but doing it live was actually more difficult on TV than radio. And usually it's the other way around.
Yeah, that's interesting. I wouldn't have considered it quite that way, but you're right. You're kind of restricted to, I better talk about what the viewer is seeing, and instead of just looking around and being able to kind of capture the whole picture. You mentioned that this came in waves. You've been doing this job for a while. Have you ever seen anything like that? There's been a pile of, you know, line brawls and stuff over the years, but one where just face-off after face-off after face-off, somebody's dropping them and we're starting all over again.
Yeah, no, I had never seen anything like that, and I haven't seen anything like it since. People have asked me, though, Matt, you know, like, you know, could you tell that it was going to be a record-setting? I couldn't tell if it was going to be a record-setting night, because I got to be honest, I didn't know what the record was. It was that's not a stat that I kept in my head. And to be honest with you, you know, with that team, you know, I never thought of that as the kind of team that would be close to setting the record. You know, when I think of, you know, records that would come, records like that, I was thinking a lot about, you know, the 1970s Flyers and the Bruins, and that was kind of my, you know, my recollection of, you know, the biggest ones of all time. And I just never thought in that era that you would see that, you know, that would be something that you would see.
Right.
So, you know, I never really thought about it in that sense. And, you know, stuff we found out afterwards, you know, where basically Ken Hitchcock was going to players and saying, "Hey, your line's up next and you got to grab somebody." Like, he was telling them they had to fight, you know. And I guess John LeClair was arguing with his coach saying, "I'm not going to fight anyone. What are you talking about? I'm not here to, I'm a hockey, you know." Yeah. And basically, it's like for Ken Hitchcock, it turned into slap shot. Like, he was going up and down the bench saying, you know, like, and I found it interesting, you know, again, I wasn't there because I'm still up in the booth afterwards when Bobby Clark had to be restrained by security because he was trying to get in the Ottawa locker room to go after Jacques Martin. And, you know, that got held up. The weird, when you think about the Big Bad Flyers, if you actually look at those two rosters afterwards and try to evaluate where they are, the team that was most able to play that kind of game was Ottawa, not Philadelphia. They just had more players on their team who were capable in those areas. And I think that's why Bobby Clark was so angry, because with the exception of the Ray Brashear fight, most of his players in those fights either lost the fight or at best were even. But, you know,
it's Radovan Somak. It's man, like, Patrick Sharp is out there now. He's fighting Spez, hardly a heavyweight title there, but Bronco Radivojevic, and there's a couple. Poor Matthias Tamander, he gets squared off with Chara. That's not a lineup you're ever looking to see.
No. Well, you know, the thing about that one, Matt, is that's one of the ones I still, you know, people ask me stories about this game. That's one of the stories I tell, is that he was kind of out there and Chara was on the ice, but he was, you know, in the other end of, you know, in the Flyer end, and, you know, he was well aware of the fact that he wasn't tied up with anybody. And when he saw that the only guy left that wasn't linked up with anybody was Chara, and Chara was skating towards him, he started screaming. I mean, like, screaming in fear, screaming to the bench for help. Like, it's the only time in a game and you got to remember, we're in the press box. We're not close. Yeah. And he was screaming in fear so loud. He was terrified. He was absolutely
terrified. I can't say I blame
terrified.
Him, Dean.
Like, I get that. But, you know, like, when I say you look at the rosters, you know, Ottawa had, you know, that day Ottawa had Chara, and they had Fisher, and they had Van Allen, and they had Neal, and they had Todd Simpson, and they had Rob Ray. Mm-hmm. And if you look at, you know, guys that are capable in that area, who did Philadelphia have? You know, they had Chris Therrien was there, but he had already been thrown out, and LeClaire and Donald Brashear.
Right.
And that was it. And, you know, Brashear not only, I think, started things with that first fight with Rob Ray, which he won handily. Rob Ray was bleeding from everywhere, eyes, ears, nose, mouth. He was a mess. But then when Brashear was leaving the ice, he sucker punched Brian Pothier on his way off the ice, and that got the rest of the Ottawa bench inflamed. You know, here's a guy who's, you know, leaving the ice and his fight is over, and he just punches a guy in the head on his way off the ice, a guy who's on the bench, and that, you know, that started another wave.
If I recall, I think I saw an interview with Havlat that he said that Jacques Martin may have saved his life that day by sending him to the penalty box to serve someone else's misconduct who had been thrown out of the game, so that he didn't actually have to end up in this melee.
Yeah. Yeah. It's wild. When I knew you and I were going to be talking about this, I looked up some stuff yesterday and stuff that I had forgotten. It's not like I didn't know it in the first place. Cause like you said, I do get asked about this a lot, but, you know, sometimes it's not stuff I've got burned into my memory,
sure.
But, 21 majors and 20 ejections. And that did remind me that, you know, near the end of the game for both teams, near the end of the game, both teams had more coaches on their bench than they had players. Like both teams, like it was a bizarre thing. And, you know, you go back and you remember I remember talking to Chris Therrien about this years later, because Chris became one of the Flyers broadcasters on radio. And back in the days, you know, it's a long time ago, but back in the days when I smoked, he also smoked. Mm. So we would go to his little hidey, because you weren't allowed to smoke in the building in Philadelphia or in any building. But he had this one little area, the security guards knew him, so they let him go into this stairwell and smoke, and they didn't bother him. And he would take me with him, so I got. And we had conversations about this, and Chris was telling me that, you know, like, he was already in the locker room. He was one of the first guys kicked out. So he's in the locker room. He said, and then more guys come in. And then a couple of minutes later, and then more guys come in. And then I was in the locker room thinking, what the hell is going on out there? So he got back out of the shower, and he's just sitting there watching on TV going, okay, more guys are going to be coming in now. It's just like, it was wave after wave after wave.
One of the things that Rob speculated about as a longtime Sens fan was that he thought, you know, sort of like you're talking about here, this lineup now for Ottawa was more capable of this at the time than Philly, with Todd Simpson and Chris Neal and Rob Ray. And the team had clearly made an effort to beef up a little bit. And this is an era where, in his memory, guys or the team had been criticized for not being hard enough, right? Or had been, you know, too skilled, not enough pushback. They keep running into the Leafs, who are kind of mugging them in the playoffs and things like that. And so they had sort of beefed up, and that maybe this was a boiling point for them as like, we're not getting pushed around here. We're going to show that reputation isn't correct. Do you put anything into that theory at all, or buy into the?
Well, I don't think at the moment when this was going on, that was, you know, there was that wider view of things, that, you know, take two steps back and get a wider view of the team and how it's going to react for the rest of the year and the makeup of the team. This was, you're in the middle of a street fight and the street fight's still going on. What are you going to do? But I definitely think as they took a step back, and I think probably for both teams, you know, that's one of the things that Chris Therrien was telling me, you know, about their team, that team at that time. They were not a tough team, as we've gone over. And it was really, he said, you know, very, very much a bonding thing for their team, because they knew they weren't made up of those kinds of players, but they were still incredibly proud of themselves for standing up for each other. Even though, like I said, you know, they didn't win most of the fights. Brashear did, and, you know, LeClaire and Chris Therrien kind of held their own with their guys. LeClaire was with Redden, and, you know, they basically just grappled with each other. But it was largely the same, I think, for Ottawa, in that you're right, you know, they knew they had some of those guys on their team. And, you know, over the course of regular play, you know, one guy would get in a fight in a normal game and that would be it. And, you know, but, you know, in a game like this, it makes you feel differently about your team when it's become that kind of a game and you become the dominant team. Mm-hmm. You know, Ottawa, people forget, Ottawa lost that game. You know, it's you know, Ottawa lost that game.
Sort of secondary to the story, yeah, I guess.
5-2 or 5-3 or whatever it is, but they lost the game. But they probably, as a group, gained something more important at that time, which was, you know, more of a swagger, more of a, you know, it really codified them as a team where, you know, they're fighting for each other and with each other. And I know people that have never played competitive body contact athletics always think that this kind of stuff is bunk, but it really brought them together as a team, as, like I say, as it did for Philadelphia as well, because again, they weren't really built for that. And Ottawa was a far more dominant team. And, you know, it just in that area with the players that they had. And so I think it ended up being, you know, one of those things for both of the teams.
Right. Who was the most, you know, on the Sens side of it, who was the most unlikely combatant in your mind? Was it Spez? Is it Lalim? Like, there's a couple guys that got into this that maybe you wouldn't have expected to. Who was the least likely pugilist?
You know what?
Smolinski, maybe?
Well, yeah, I think probably Smolinski, just because I'd never seen him be in a fight ever, number one. You know, and for Smolinski, he was a guy that was really never part of the game, and he and Recky were friends. That was the other thing. Like, okay. they knew each other, which was kind of interesting. But that's who he got linked up, and you know. But I think I wasn't really shocked about Lalim, because I knew the kind of guy he was. I know that Robert Ash was very surprised to see him right there staring at him with his gear off, ready to go. And Robert Ash had no understanding of what was going on. And to be honest with you, with Spez, I wasn't really surprised because we always used to joke with Spez. You know, Spez used to joke and say, I got to get in my one fight, because his thing was every season I got to get in at least one fight so people respect the fact that I will fight.
Right.
So we always used to laugh about, so when's the fight coming up? It was a joke kind of thing. So I knew that he didn't have a problem with fighting and didn't know this was going to be his one fight, but we always used to laugh with Spez about him getting in his one fight a year to make sure everybody in the league knew that he was always willing to fight and he wasn't going to be a pushover.
Well, he did that right up to the end in Toronto. There was a brawl in Winnipeg. He was still jumping in at 38 or whatever. They were about to be eliminated in the bubble by Columbus. He was the one who fought trying to get the guys going. Like it wasn't a common sight, but it wasn't all that uncommon either, I guess, right?
He was pretty much true to his word. A couple of times he had two, but like he had at least one fight every year, and that wasn't by accident. You know, at that time in the league still, he wanted people to know that, you know, you might think that you can just do whatever you want, he's not going to react. Even just having one good fight a year told people around the league, you know, he's not that kind of guy. So I think you're right. I think for me, probably the one that surprised me was Smolinski Recchi, because I didn't think of either of those two guys as guys that were, you know, into that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But again, you know, I think Recchi was angry though. So that was one thing. But with some of the guys who were in the fights, like I said, you know, they didn't want to be in fights. Their coach, Ken Hitchcock, you know,
yes.
You know, if you did that nowadays, you'd be suspended by the league for, you know, it's fighting is, you know, like, you know, coaches don't go up to players. And even back then, coaches don't go up to players by and large and say, you got to get out there and you got to fight.
Right.
You know, there might be some innuendo and, you know, like guys know what their job is. You might walk behind the guy who's the fighter on the team and just walk by and say, are we going to allow that, boys? Are we going to allow that? Well, you might be talking to the boys, but you're talking to one guy and he hears you. You know what I mean? Like, but to actually go up to John LeClair and say, when you get on the ish, you got to pick somebody and fight them.
Well, Patrick, you know, Sharp, like, has been interviewed and said in no uncertain terms that Hitchcock came to him and said, the next time Spets is on the ice, you're on the ice and you're going with him, because they're the rookies, right? Or they're the young guys at the time. This is a weight class you can handle kind of thing. And so there's no ambiguity there. There's no boys about it. It's you and it's that guy. Get out there.
Sharp, actually.
Spez was replying, or like, and I've seen him interviewed about it too, said, you know, he didn't know specifically it would be Sharp, but he goes, I'm the rookie here. I can't be the only guy left on the bench. If I get a chance, I'm going to go.
Oh, absolutely. The thing too for Sharp is people sometimes forget that was his second fight. He stayed in the game because the fight that he was in, I shouldn't even say the fight. I'm not even sure that the linesman, for whatever reason, they were just there. So one of them jumped in early, but he actually got grabbed by Todd Simpson. Mm. So he got really lucky, because if that one would have gotten going, Simpson would have hurt him badly. Simpson was bigger and very good at that. And, you know, Sharp was smaller and not good at all at that. And so later on, Simpson, I think Simpson mopped up Danny Markov later on. That was Simpson's bigger one.
Well, and when Simpson he was allowed Brashear twice, like after Brashear fought Ray and they're escorting Ray to the box, Simpson takes a run at Brashear and they start going. So
And I can't remember, Chris Neal got penalized for the fight with Radovan Somek, but actually at that time behind the net he had two of them. He had two flyers and he was fighting them both at the same time on purpose. Like he was the one who grabbed both of them.
Right.
And so he was sweater punching both of them, you know, where they hold the sweater and punch at the same time. So I'm trying to remember who the second guy was.
I think it might have been Michael Hanzus.
Might have been Hanzus. Michael Hanzus ended up, his big fight in that game, I remember that was with Mike Fisher, and for Hanzus.
No.
Hanzus did not enjoy that, because if you remember Mike Fisher, not a huge guy, 6 feet tall, 200, 210, you know, not a monster sized guy, but incredibly strong for his size. But also he was like a Gatling gun fighter. Like when he started, there'd be 20 punches in 9 seconds. Like he just, and I remember watching that fight, the Fisher Hanzus fight, and Hanzus probably took 10 in the face before he knew he was in a fight, and then it went downhill from there. And it was Redden and LeClaire ended up being pretty good. LeClaire was a far larger man, but Red's growing up playing in the Western League, sure, was not adverse to this kind of stuff. But John was such a strong guy, and Red's got in several shots, but he took some doozies just because John LeClaire wasn't a fighter, but just such a big strong guy.
Yeah.
Redden took a couple of nasty ones there, but and he dished them out too. But, LeClaire was such a big, such a strong guy. Reds fared well, but he took a couple of pretty hard ones in that one.
He was fighting up a weight class for sure.
Yeah, he was.
Last thing on this, then I'm curious, is there any chance in today's NHL anything like this ever happens again? It feels to me like it's 5-game suspensions across the board for everybody into the second and third fights after those referee warnings. And 2004 is not the 70s or 80s, but it is still a fairly different game than it is today.
Yeah, no, very, very different, Matt. It's a very different game, very different philosophy. I don't see this record ever being broken, simply because, and we saw it with Ottawa earlier this year. I'd never heard this, but now, before, but now you have officials who just say everybody on the ice is kicked out.
Yeah, I saw that.
You know what I mean? So if you had this now, you wouldn't have the opportunities for guys to be in 2 or 3 fights.
Right.
It just wouldn't happen. Guys, guys wouldn't be in games. They would, as soon as one fight, you're going to go to the box, but then if you come back to the bench and things start again, you're out of the game.
Right.
So this idea that you're coming back, for Todd Simpson to have been engaged with as many guys as he was at different times in that game, just would never happen now. It just wouldn't happen,
right.
And anyway, it was interesting. And at the time, I was unaware that this was going to end up being the most penalized game in NHL history. That just was not the sense that you got when you were doing the game,
Yeah. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you quickly before we let you go about the modern day Sens, who in January and earlier in February looked like they were turning things around and the Jacques Martin effect was starting to set in. But the last week or so, they've hit another skid. What have you made of what you've seen of them lately? Do you see some better habits creeping back in, or have they slipped lately? Where are you at with them right now?
Well, I think that it's a bit of both of what you're saying. There are games where you see those better habits slipping in, and they play really well against really good teams. But then when you watch them play against Chicago and Anaheim and some of the teams near the bottom of the standings down where they are, and it's like, where did that come from? Everything was trending in the right direction. And I think that's one of the big issues with this team right now. It's maturity and its ability to have some consistency in their game, where even when you don't have your best game, the drop-off isn't as dramatic as it's been. And that is still, to my way of thinking, one of the major issues with this team, is their ability to have some consistency in their game, both individuals having consistency in their game and as a team having consistency in your game. But any team in this league can beat any other team on any given day. The talent level and the way teams play now, any team can win. The difference between the good teams and the bad teams is the good teams don't have massive drops in their consistency. When they don't play well, and every team plays well some nights and not well the other nights, when really good teams don't play well, whatever grading system, if they're normally, a B level team, when they don't have a good night, they're a C level team. They don't become an E level team.
Right.
And Ottawa right now is going through those massive swings. On some nights you watch them play and you'd say, well, there's a team that should be able to challenge for a playoff spot. And then you see them on other nights and you go, what is that? And I think that's the big issue. And when you combine it with very inconsistent goaltending, that's where you get what you get here. You hate to dump this much on two guys, but that's just the way it is in the goaltending business. When you are 32nd in a 32-team league in team save percentage, you're not getting good enough goaltending on a regular basis to be a team that can compete for a playoff spot. Yeah. So I think for me, you know, the wild inconsistencies, both in individuals' play, where, you know, one guy can look like an all-star one night and then you wonder how he stays in the league the next night. You know, that, I think that's some of the frustration that you have with the coaching staff and management as they're trying to evaluate what they have and what they want to do going forward. Is on some nights you see the best of a player and it's really impressive, and on other nights you go, wow, that is not impressive. And trying to figure out, you know, as a group, as a hockey ops department, trying to figure out which is closer to what the guy really is. You know, you're hoping it's that really good side, but some nights they make you wonder whether it's that good side is there enough. And I think that's where they're at right now. I think consistency in their level of play, both individually and as a team, is the biggest issue. Because, you know, Matt, you see what's going on here. There's some nights where you watch them play against really good teams. Like when they played Dallas, Dallas was the number one team in the league, and Dallas didn't lose that game. Ottawa beat them. You know, Ottawa was the better team. 100%. And then you watch them play Anaheim, or you watch that Chicago game, and you go, what the hell was that? You know, that's one of the issues for, you know, the coaching staff and for hockey ops, is that, you know, how do you try to get this group, you know, to play at a consistent level, doing the same things consistently well over and over again, so you can count on the level that they're capable of. And that right now is a big frustration.
You expect to see much before the deadline here, Friday, offloading of anything, or it'll be pretty quiet?
Well, you know what? I think it's going to be about as much as the market will allow. I can tell you that Steve Staio, he's always on the phone. Like if not enough things change here, it won't be because he didn't try to make things happen. He's doing as much as he can to try and change the mix on this team, because it's pretty clear this team needs a little bit of a jolt, right, and a change in its configuration. That's pretty clear. And it really, I think, Matt, is going to depend on what the marketplace will allow. You know, if you look right now, I am really surprised at how little movement there has been around the league this close to the trade deadline, you know. And that's because there are so many teams that are so close.
It's a mushy middle, right? Yeah. That hasn't separated yet.
No, you're absolutely right. That's exactly the point. And, you know, if you look at Nashville, for example, you know, Nashville, they didn't say it, but they said it. You know, Barry Trotz wants to remake his team, but he's sitting in a playoff spot.
Right. They've won six or eight in a row. What are you going to do?
I don't think they thought they would be there. And
Flyers,
I think that
very much the same. I think Flyers, they expected to sell a bit this year and change them. Now you're in it.
Yeah.
Like, you can't decimate
I think there's several teams, like you said, that mushy middle where they're close enough to either catch up or have a chance at it, or they're in a spot and they're seemingly for no good reason holding on to it. You know, so I think that's why you're seeing such little movement, and why managers want to do something, but they also don't want to mess with the team that's going to make the playoffs. You know, you got to remember that in the playoffs, the NHL, for every game in the league, the NHL in the first round gets half of the proceeds from every gate in the league. And that's how the NHL is funded. You know, that's, you know, 1/33 of TV revenues and playoff seat revenues in the first round, half of them, they go to the league. So if you're a team, and you're making the playoffs and you think it's going to be, you know, $2 million, you know, we'll say low in Toronto, New York, Chicago, LA, the number's bigger, Vancouver, the number's bigger. But sure, if you say that, you know, a game in the playoffs is a $2 million gate, people say, well, yeah, but you have to give half that to the league. But for a team, yeah, but you keep the other million.
Right.
You know, it's not just saying, well, you know, if we don't make the playoffs, it's still $1 million a game you're going to lose or not get.
Yeah.
And so it's
your fourth line center for the year, right?
Like, yeah, exactly. It's not nothing. And, you know, so it's not something to be blown off as, well, we were going to make some changes, we just decided to go do it and see if we make the playoffs anyway. It's not, you know, it's not that simple. There's a little more to it. There's a lot of money involved. And the other thing too is that there's always the side of it, Matt, where a manager really wants to be conscious of what he's telling his players. And there are players on teams that are close or that are in, and even though they're close with their teammates, they also know that they're competitive people and they want to win. So you want to tell your players that you're going to support them and you're going to make some changes to try and make the team better. And even though they might have to say goodbye to a couple of friends, they don't mind that because they know you're trying to make the team better to support them. If you don't do anything at the deadline, you're just kind of saying to your team that, well, I didn't think you'd get this far, and we don't want to waste any of the future on this year and on you. So, you know, a manager also has to be a guy like Barry Trotz or Briere in Philadelphia. You know, those two guys, because we're talking about them, they have to be very careful about the message that they send to their locker room about believing in them and believing in their abilities to hold on to a playoff spot. You don't want to extinguish that belief within your team because that can have an effect on your relationship with the players on the team next year and the year after, you know, when they're, well, he didn't do anything for us last year to help us get, you know, like, and that's part of the dynamic that very few people outside of the game ever really look at, but it can be pretty important. You know, Brian Murray used to be a guy that would say, you know, to the players, to the media, you know, I've talked to the leadership group on the team. They know it's going to mean that some of their friends are going to leave, but they want us to make this team better before the players. I want to do it for them because I believe in them and I want them to know that I believe in them. And that's the way you demonstrate that as a manager, is you go and try and get something to help them get there. And even if it doesn't work out that you do, it's important that they know that you're willing to support them and you believe in them and you go and try and get them some help. And that's a part of the hockey relationship a lot of times that the people don't know of or understand around trade deadline. They just think it's dollars, cents, accounting. It's more than that for certain teams.
Yeah, well, and like you said, there's a lot of teams kind of in that weird spot where they're going to have to know their guys, read their room, and figure out how in this they actually are. So it'll be an interesting week, but I think you're right. It might be a quieter week than some deadlines have been. But go ahead.
I was just going to say, Matt, if Ottawa doesn't make as many deals, there's going to be some. There has to be. Mm-hmm. He can't have spent this much time on his cell phone and not end up making any deals. My God, I said to him last week, I said, you know, you're going to get a cauliflower ear like a wrestler. He said, why? I said, when are you? He said, yeah, I got to use the AirPods more. He said, my ear is getting sore. So now when you see him walking around, he's got the AirPods in a lot now just to save his ear getting mushed up. But if he doesn't make as many deals as the Ottawa Senators, as some of the fans want, it's not because he's not trying to make deals. Believe me, he's trying to make things happen. He's trying to shake things up without giving away the farm.
I always appreciate you making time for me, Dean, and it's a fun story, the brawl. It's something that I know comes up in this market every year, and I know you have a unique perspective on it, having been in the building, so I appreciate you coming on and talking to me about it.
Anytime, Matt.
All right, there goes legendary Ottawa Senators play-by-play man, Dean Brown. Always great when he makes a little time for us, and that was fun. He had a unique perspective on the game and had seen everything that went down there in person that night. The sound of a guy screaming for his life as Zdeno Chara comes tearing towards you, ready to pound you into the ice. A perspective that maybe we didn't get on television. You had to be there to know that that's what went down. So fun chat with Dean. Hope you all enjoyed that. Don't forget, Wednesday, Andrea from the Bytown Beer Sisters will be here. Lever Sage on Thursday, Steve Bunda on Friday, and maybe another bonus episode or two this week, depending on what goes on around the trade deadline. If there's anything big that happens, anything worth firing up the studio for, we will do that as well. So hope you'll stick around. Thanks for listening. Have yourselves a great day.
That's it. Cannot work under these conditions.
If anybody wants me, I'll be downstairs at McDougal's.
Call the weekend guy. I don't care.